Pull up a chair. Walk the vintage rows here at Oshkosh some morning before the crowds thicken, before the announcers get warmed up, when the grass is still wet and the light comes in low and gold across the ramp. Sooner or later you'll find yourself standing in front of a big, gangly biplane the color of old butter. Two wings. A wooden propeller as long as a man is tall. A nose that sticks out proud in front of an open cockpit, and behind it another cockpit, because this was a two-seater, a schoolhouse with wings. That's a Curtiss JN4, a Jenny. And I want to tell you this morning that just about everything you're standing in the middle of this week, 500,000 people, the airplane stacked wingtip to wingtip clear out to the horizon, the whole grand idea that ordinary Americans belong in the sky, a big piece of all of it traces back to that homely yellow biplane and a fire sale the United States government held after the First World War. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, on Radio Hangar, broadcasting all week from the showgrounds at Whitman Regional Airport in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Grab your coffee. This one's a good one. Now, here's where it gets interesting, and let me set the scene the way it really was. The year is 1918, the war ends in November, and it ends fast, faster than anybody planned for, and the United States, which had been cranking up an aviation machine to fight in France, suddenly finds itself sitting on a mountain of airplanes. It does not need training airplanes, mostly, and the airplane it had trained damn near every American military pilot in was the Curtiss JN4. The Jenny, the name came from the letters JN, said out loud until it sounded like a girl's name. Pilots do that, they always have. Curtiss built these things by the thousands, somewhere north of 6,000 of them all told, between the factory in Hammondsport, New York, and licensed builders all over the country. It was a good, honest trainer. A wood frame, spruce and ash, wrapped in cotton fabric doped, taut, and painted. A Curtiss OX5 engine up front. A V8, water-cooled, making all of 90 horsepower on a good day, when it wasn't throwing a rocker arm. And it threw a lot of rocker arms, cruised about 60, 65 miles an hour. Landed slow enough that grass and a cow pasture were all the runway you needed. And after the armistice, the army didn't want them anymore. So the government did what governments do. It declared them surplus and it sold them off, crated up. Brand new, never flown, some of them still packed in the factory grease. And the prices, friends. The prices, you could buy a Jenny, a complete airplane, for a few hundred dollars. As the surplus stock dragged on into the early 20s and the crates kept turning up, the price kept falling. Some fellows tell you they bought one, crate and all, for around $50 and a promise, get one running with a spare engine thrown in and you were still under $1,000. There had never been anything like it in the history of the world, an airplane, a real flying airplane, for the price of a good used automobile, sometimes less. Now think about what that meant. Before the war, if you wanted to fly, you needed to be rich, or you needed to be an exhibition daredevil working for the Wright or Curtiss companies, or you needed to join the military. Airplanes were rare, hand-built, precious things. The average American had maybe seen one once at a fair as a speck in the sky. And then, almost overnight, the country was awash in flyable airplanes that cost next to nothing. And it was full of young men who had just learned to fly them in the service and had absolutely no intention of going back to the plow or the shop counter. That collision, cheap airplanes and restless pilots, that's the spark. That's the whole thing. That is the barnstorming era being born. Before I get too far down the runway, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today.
Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And that's the thing I like about it, because that's what today's whole segment is about, isn't it? The stories behind the milestones. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So there's your young pilot, 1920, he's got a Jenny, maybe went in with an army buddy to split the cost, now what, now he flies. But you can't eat flying, you've got to make the airplane pay for itself, for the gas, for the oil, and that OX-5 drank oil like it had a grudge, and for beans and coffee and a roof when it rained. So he does the only thing there is to do. He goes looking for people who have never been off the ground and are dying to find out what it's like, and that's the word, barnstorming. It comes out of the theater, out of the traveling acting troops who'd play any barn or town hall that would have them, storming from one to the next. The pilots borrowed it, because that's exactly what they did. Picture it, a summer afternoon in the 20s, somewhere in the middle of America, Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, a single Jenny comes droning in low over a little farm town, low enough to rattle the windows, low enough that everybody in the diner and the feed store and the schoolhouse comes running out into the street to look up. The pilot picks his field, some farmer's flat pasture on the edge of town, and he sets her down in the grass, bouncing over the gopher holes, and he shuts her down. And he waits, because he knows.
Within the hour, here they come, down the dirt road in their Model Ts and their wagons and on foot, the whole town. Kids first, always the kids, then the young folks, then everybody. They've never been this close to an airplane. They can smell it now, and this is the part the history books leave out. An airplane in 1920 had a smell, hot castor oil, because a lot of those engines ran castor oil and it threw a fine mist back over everything. Sweet and sharp. Doped fabric, that banana and lacquer smell that anybody who's been around a fabric airplane knows in their bones. Gasoline, scorched exhaust, fresh cut grass and manure from the pasture. And the pilot standing by the wing in his boots and his jodhpurs and his leather helmet shoved back on his head says the magic words. $5 and I'll take you up. Now here's where it gets interesting, because those first flights, that's the beating heart of the whole thing. For most of these folks, farmers, shopkeepers, their kids, their grandmothers, that ride in the front seat of a Jenny was the single most extraordinary thing that would ever happen to them in their entire lives. They climbed into that front cockpit and the pilot firewalled that tired old 90-horse V8, and the tail came up and the ground fell away. And for the first time in the history of their family, going back to the beginning of time, a human being in their bloodline left the earth. They saw their own town from above, their own house, their own fields laid out like a quilt. The river they'd fished their whole life suddenly a silver ribbon. Men wept, women screamed and laughed at the same time. Kids never ever forgot it. And a lot of those kids grew up to be the pilots who built the airlines, who flew in the Second World War, who founded the outfits whose airplanes are parked all around us this week. You want to know where American aviation came from? It came from a $5 ride in a butter yellow Jenny out of a cow pasture. Of course, competition being what it is, the plane hop and a ride business got crowded fast. Every county had two or three Jennies working it by the mid-20s. So the pilots had to give the crowd more. They had to give them a show. And this is where the flying got wild. This is where the flying circus is born. Whole troops of airplanes and performers traveling together. They'd loop the Jenny, roll it, spin it down toward the crowd, and pull out at the last second. And then the wing walkers, and I've told the story of Ormer Locklear on this program before, so I won't steal his thunder today, but there were dozens like him, men and women both, out on the wings of these airplanes, with nothing but their grip and their nerve. Stuntmen would hang by their teeth. A fellow would climb from a speeding car up a rope ladder into a Jenny. Parachute jumps, mid-air transfers from one airplane to another. The Jenny was perfect for it, and not because it was a great airplane, it wasn't, really. It was perfect because it was slow and it was forgiving and it was everywhere. It flew slow enough that a human being could stand up on the top wing in the wind and not get blown off. It landed slow enough to use any field. And when you bent one, and they bent a lot of them, parts were cheap and plentiful because there were thousands of the things. You could practically build a whole airplane out of the pieces of the ones that didn't make it. It was dangerous work. I won't sugarcoat that. A great many of these young pilots and performers were killed, and it was that toll. The crashes at county fairs, the funerals that eventually pushed the country to write real rules for flying. The Air Commerce Act of 1926. Pilot licenses, aircraft certification. The beginning of what would become the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA that we all answer to today. Barnstorming, in a way, wrote its own ending. The rules it inspired grounded the free-for-all that created it. By the late 20s, the era was fading. The surplus Jennies were wearing out, and the government finally banned a lot of them from carrying passengers. Newer, better airplanes came along. The Lindbergh flight in 27 turned the whole country's attention toward serious commercial aviation. The Barnstormers moved on into the airlines they helped create, into the airmail, into the war that was coming. But here's why I wanted to tell you this today, standing here on the Oshkosh grass. Look around you this week. This gathering, this whole thing, this is the barnstorming spirit that never died. It just found a home. The Experimental Aircraft Association, the EAA, that puts on this show, it grew out of that exact same restless idea that flying belongs to regular people, that you don't have to be rich or military, that a fellow can get his hands on an airplane and go see the country from up top. Paul Poberesny and the folks who started this in a Milwaukee basement, they were carrying the same torch those Jenny pilots lit in the cow pastures. And if you walk over to the EAA Aviation Museum right here on the grounds, or you find the antique airplanes down in the vintage area, you will find Jennies. Lovingly restored, fabric tight, that OX-5 up front, brought back to life by people who understand exactly what that airplane meant. Every rib stitch done by hand. Some of these restorations take a lifetime, and the folks who do them will talk your ear off about it. And God bless them for it, because they're keeping the real story flying. Go find one this week, stand in front of it, smell the dope and the oil if she's been running, and think about a nervous farmer in 1922, climbing into that front seat, about to become the first person in the history of his family to touch the sky, all for $5 he probably couldn't spare. That's where you came from, every one of us. That's the ground floor. My thanks this morning to the good people at the EAA Aviation Museum and the vintage restorers who keep these airplanes airworthy, and to the aviation historians who've kept the tales of the flying circuses from being forgotten. You can find more of what we do over at radiohangar.com. I'm going to go get another cup of coffee and walk the vintage rows one more time before it gets crowded. That's the best flying there is, the kind you do with your feet on the grass and your eyes wide open. See you out there.